Today is Wednesday, October the 11th. We're on God's Salvation Through History. Last week we looked at the Hebrew word used in the Old Testament for salvation. We went through a little bit of defining it as far as Yeshuah, that and how it was used concerning deliverance from man's time of needs and either regard to war, servitude, distress, or enemies. We started looking at some of the examples of various words that were being translated from the Hebrew word Yeshua, giving different thoughts being conveyed to the reader's mind. And we looked at, like in Psalms chapter 44, verses 4 and 5, the thought there where the word is translated deliverance, where he says, "Thou art my King, O God, command deliverances for Jacob. Through thee will we push down our enemies, through thy name will we tread them under that rise up against us." So we looked at the word there as far as being deliverance. We looked in Job, the 30th chapter, in verse 15, as far as the word meaning welfare or prosperity, that deliverance or salvation has a significant part in one's welfare or within their prosperity. It also is used and translated the same word as far as health, in not only deliverance or salvation, but health. If you would look at 2 Samuel, the 10th chapter, and we'll look at some of these, and then we'll see the various uses to see the setting, the emphasis that the writers are trying to get across in the Old Testament writing. 2 Samuel chapter 10, verse 11. 2 Samuel 10, 11. "And he said, if the Syrians be too strong for me, then thou shalt help me. But if the children of Ammon be too strong for thee, then I will come and help thee." Again, there, help being used for deliverance or for salvation. In Psalms, the 3rd chapter. Psalms, the 3rd chapter, verses 1 and 2. "Lord, how are they that increase that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. Many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for him in God." Again, the thought, help being salvation or deliverance from God. In the 22nd Psalm, verses 1 and 2 again, where it's often kind of brought over into the New Testament, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou so far from helping me and from the words of my roaring? O my God, I cry in the daytime, but thou hearest not, and in the night season, and am not silent." Again, the thought here of salvation or deliverance with the term help in that being used. In Psalms, the 42nd chapter, in verse 5, the writer says, "Why art thou cast down, O my soul, and why art thou disquieted in me? Hope thou in God, for I shall yet praise him for the help of his countenance." Again, there, the thought with deliverance or salvation. Another word that is used in Psalms, the 28th chapter, in verse 8, is saving strength. 28th chapter. In verse 8, "The Lord is their strength, and he is the saving strength of his anointed." Again, the saving strength or strength referring to the salvation or the deliverance that God can supply. In Psalms, the 42nd chapter, the writers there use the word help in some of these passages here to convey the idea of deliverance or salvation, and that being health, H-E-A-L-T-H, health. Psalms 42:11, "And thou art cast down, O my soul, and why art thou disquietest within me? Hope thou in God, for I shall yet praise him, who is the health of my countenance and my God." And there they use the word help. The 43rd Psalm there, and in verse 5, "Why art thou cast down, O my soul? Why art thou disquieted within me? Hope in God, for I shall yet praise him, who is the health of my countenance and my God." When you turn to the 67th Psalm, verses 1 and 2, it said, "God be merciful unto us and bless us and cause his face to shine upon us, that thy way may be known upon earth, thy saving help among all nations." So you have the idea of God's deliverance or His salvation be known among all nations, and here the writer refers to it as saving help. It's also used as salvation, just straight out, the word salvation in place of Yeshua. When you look at Genesis, the 49th chapter, in verse 18, I have waited for thy salvation, O thy Lord. It's the same word. Here again, the thought of waiting for God's deliverance, and they use the word salvation there. In Exodus, the 14th chapter, in verse 13, Moses there is telling the people, fear ye not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which He will show you today. For the Egyptians whom ye have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forever. Again, the thought of deliverance that is taking place for salvation from that standpoint that is recognized in God. 1 Chronicles, the 16th chapter. 16th chapter and verse 23. He says, sing unto the Lord all the earth, show forth from day to day His salvation. So, to show forth the glories of the Lord concerning His deliverance that He exercises upon those upon the earth. Isaiah, the 49th chapter, recorded there in the 49th chapter, in verse 8. Thus saith the Lord, in an acceptable time have I heard thee, and in a day of salvation have I helped thee. And I will preserve thee and give thee for a covenant of the people to establish the earth, to cause to inherit the desolate heritages. So again, the thought being that in times of distress, servitude, wars, battles, enemies, whatever, it can be used in different formats as far as the word Yeshua. So we see here it can be used as deliverance, welfare, help, saving strength, help, or salvation. In the New Testament, the Greek word most commonly used for salvation is soteria. And with the main thought there is of rescue and safety. Now, normally what we associate it with in the New Testament is the spiritual salvation. But there are cases of where the thought is of rescue and safety. Soteria denotes deliverance, preservation, or salvation, and is used of material and temporal deliverance from danger and apprehension. So that is how it's used in the New Testament. It says described as deliverance in the New Testament for the nation of Israel in a national sense. And by that I mean as far as the nation being delivered. When you look at Luke, the first chapter, we can see the national sense of it being used. Luke, the first chapter, verse 69, recorded there, and hath raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, in regards to speaking to the Jews, down in verse 71, that we should be saved from our enemies and from the hand of all that hate us. There's talking about all those that hated Israel as a nation, those that persecuted and were against the nation in that sense. In Acts 7th chapter, we see another use of it there in the national sense. In the 7th chapter of Acts, is verse 24 and 25, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, and referring to Moses and the Hebrews and the Egyptian that were fighting, and seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. Again, the deliverance on a national sense of the nation. It is described as preservation and safety for persons in a personal sense. Not only in a national sense, but also in a personal sense in the New Testament. It is mentioned in regards to the personal sense from drowning, from one drowning. When you look at Acts, the 27th chapter, there in the shipwreck of Paul and so forth, in the 27th chapter, in verse 34, as the ship was sinking and so forth, Paul told the fellow sailors and them, he said, "Wherefore I pray you to take some meat, for this is for your health. For there shall not a hair fall from your head of any one of you." And there you see the word termed health. This is for your health. Well, it wasn't meaning that, you know, as far as sickness or anything like that, but it had to do with their deliverance or their preservation or their safety. The literal Greek writing is, "Therefore I beg you to take a food, this for to your salvation is." And that's the original Greek in that. And it's been translated "help" again in the King James Version. In Philippians, the first chapter, verse 19, it's concerning safety and preservation from prison and bonds that Paul was enduring. Philippians, the first chapter, verse 19. "For I know that this shall turn to my salvation through your prayer and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ." So there he's looking at that it would be his salvation through prayer, that if he could be released from prison and from the bonds. It's preservation or safety from the flood. When you look in Hebrews, the 11th chapter. Hebrews, the 11th chapter and verse 7. "By faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith." So there we see the saving of his house, the personal aspect of it. The thought that we most generally, again, connect with the word is the spiritual and eternal deliverance granted by God through obedience. That's what we normally associate with the word in the New Testament. With that, we're all familiar with Acts chapter 4, verse 12, that there is no other name under heaven as far as where salvation is. "Neither is there salvation in any other, for there is none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved." Again, the spiritual aspect there in that. Romans, the 10th chapter, verse 10, again, that we're all familiar with. Romans, the 10th chapter, again, in verse 10. "For with the heart man believeth unto righteousness, and with the mouth confession is made unto salvation." As far as a spiritual sense, deliverance from one's sins or the bondage of sin. And then, of course, again in Ephesians, the first chapter and verse 13. Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 13. Concerning the spiritual sense. "In whom ye also trusted after ye heard the word of truth, the gospel of your salvation." So there's the main thoughts that we have with the word as far as a national sense, a personal sense in safety and preservation. Thayer states concerning soteria as being used in two senses. The first being the ethical sense of that which conduces to the soul's safety and salvation. And the examples that he gave was Luke, the 19th chapter. And verse 9, the 19th chapter and verse 9. Jesus said to him, "This day is salvation come to this house," when he was talking to Zacchaeus. "This day is salvation come into your house." Again, conducive to the soul's safety and salvation in the ethical sense. 2 Peter, the 3rd chapter. In verse 15. Third chapter and verse 15, "In that account that the long suffering of our Lord is salvation, even as our beloved Paul also according to the wisdom given to him hath written unto you." It's from that standpoint. The second one being the technical biblical sense of the messianic salvation. That's the second sense of it as far as salvation in the messianic sayings that are done, are said in the New Testament, that's repeated as far as Jesus being the Messiah and coming to deliver us or offer salvation for our souls. So that's the second sense. There are a few less words translated from the Greek word soteria, giving different thoughts conveyed to the reader's mind. We saw there was quite a few in the Hebrew. There's a lot less in the New Testament in the Greek. In Luke, the first chapter, Luke, the first chapter, we have, of course, again, just the plain, straight word that they use there in verse 69 of salvation. He raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David. Again, that. Verse 77, to give knowledge of salvation unto his people by the remission of their sins. And in John, the fourth chapter, verse 22. You worship, you know not what, you know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. That deliverance there from that standpoint. You have deliver in Acts chapter 7 and verse 25, where the writer has translated it as deliver in Acts chapter 7 verse 25. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, and they understood not. You have health also used in Acts chapter 27 and verse 34, where again we have that verse there concerning that. Concerning the shipwreck there, and that word there is used in health in verse 34. So you have several different words in that. So that gives us somewhat of a basis to look at as far as what the word has to do. We can see either in the Old Testament or the New Testament, the word salvation is deeply connected with some form of deliverance to ensure safety or preservation. The context surrounding the word, in other words, how the writer is using it in the environment, the context surrounding the word will determine whether it is used in the physical sense, delivered from battles, delivered from distress, enemies, or servitude, or in the spiritual sense, delivered from the guilt of sin or eternal torment. And the context will supply that in how it is written and how it is used. Okay? Any question or thoughts on the word? I know that's kind of lengthy to go through the definition, but I think we need to differentiate between how it's used in the Old Testament and how it's used in the New Testament. And to expand our thought of what salvation or deliverance is. Okay? The second thing that I want to bring out with this, now that we looked at it, is when we consider God and reflect upon His attributes, there is produced within us awe and adoration because of those attributes and what He can accomplish. And this is important and has a direct bearing and effect upon the salvation and deliverance that God produces that we're going to look at. In lesson 5, we'll get through where we'll start actually looking at examples through the Old Testament of all the deliverances that God set about to do. And you'll see that there's a purpose, there's a design of why God went about and did this. Why that, it just is, and we'll see that. And so, first thing we must realize is a concept about God as far as His attributes, that when we look at Him, it has to instill and inspire in us something, considering if we actually think about them. When you look at your surroundings with all the complexities that are there and the inner workings, you can't help but ascribe this to a God who is far more superior than us. And we have to keep that in mind when we look at God as far as how superior He is. And the reason I say that is because there are certain things that I can't help you out of. There are certain things that nobody else can help you out of. When you're facing certain trials and tribulations, when you're facing certain distresses, when you're facing certain things within your life, you can't look for someone else for that deliverance at all times. Because they may not be able to be in a power or position to even deliver you or to offer you any relief. So therefore, you have to consider God. You have to look toward God for that, and He's going to be the source of that. And when you look at everything that He has done and how it all works together, that He's the originator of everything, the creator who produced all their various workings, when you look about how it all works, how all nature is interacting together concerning the animals, the plants, and mankind, and how they're all dependent and subservient to each other, it's just amazing. They all have a benefit to one another. Why do we have trees? What's the purpose of trees? To cut down, to have lumber, to build houses with, to burn as firewood? A lot of the purpose of the trees and the green plants is to convert the carbon dioxide back into oxygen for us. If we didn't, we'd run short of oxygen. But that's the purpose of the plants and the trees and so forth, to filter that just through their leaves. But it also has other uses. It provides food for the animals. It provides shelter for the animals. It provides shelter for us. I mean, just the inner workings. And for someone just to sit down and map all this out in their mind, it's going to take somebody pretty smart to do all that, to get all the work together. And man can't do that.
Well, there's another thing it does. It catches water right when it's up in these mountains. So the water won't come down and flood the people out. The trees catch it.
There is. There's. When we stop and consider all the purposes, and just consider what the purpose of something that it has, it's amazing how God had this all in mind before He even framed it, before He even put it together. And there's no way that we could have foreseen all of that. And that has to. This has to do with God's providence, His forethought, His all-knowing, His wisdom, everything. When you look at the universe and the laws that are set there, there's no way that we could even expand that out there and have done that. When you look at the planets, the moons, the sun, the cycles, the rain, the wind, the tides, the currents, I mean, they're all there for a specific purpose. They're just not there just because, well, they're there. I mean, there's a reason that there's a jet stream and it goes a certain way. You know, when you look at the cycle of water, the evaporation, condensation, and all of that, it's just a perpetual cycle. And that would end if God didn't have that in place and overseeing that every day. And that's the amazing part. It's not that God just said it once, but He oversees it every day to keep it in its workings. That's what God does. And it was just put there by His speaking, and there it was.
Well, so, Brother, for something else there in Genesis chapter 8, He said, food time in the harvest will never end as long as the world. People complain about no food. There'll be food here because God will make plans for us to have it if we just get out and kind of hit ourselves.
He has. I mean, these are His workings that He has for man. And when you think of being able to accomplish this in creation, and the continuance of such, it shows His attributes of being all-powerful, ever-present, all-knowing. By His providence, His forethought, He sustains this habitation and all things contained therein on a daily basis. His constant care is here each day. It's not that, well, we need to worry about something next week, it's each day. He is overseeing this in His constant care. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because in the problems that we face and the problems that Israel faced, it was a day-by-day problem that they had. And God was the source day-by-day of their deliverance, of their salvation, to see to their needs. Okay? In His choosing and His time. And due to all this, by the very essence of these mighty works, God is to be glorified. God is the one to be glorified. It's not based upon He has such an ego that He has to have that. But by His very nature of who He is and what He has done and what He does, is He is to be glorified. And in every case that we'll see as we go through the Old Testament on the deliverance and the salvation, that was the purpose. That should be the end result, is that God is glorified. Glorified by who? Not only by you and me, but by the world. God was glorified in a lot of these battles, even though the enemy didn't want to admit it, but they glorified God because they saw what was accomplished and how they were defeated, and God got the glory for it. And that's what's said about. God does this and offers salvation and deliverance so that He can be glorified, because He deserves that glory. It's based on His mighty and powerful works. To be glorious is to be great, to be magnificent. When you look at Exodus, the 15th chapter, verse 6, Thy right hand, O Lord, is become glorious in power. Thy right hand, O Lord, hath dashed in pieces the enemy. When you drop down to verse 11, well, who is like unto thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like thee, glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? The writer there says, pick someone that you can compare to that has done wonders what God has done. When you stop and consider what all they had seen Him do firsthand, and then stop and think of the times that He has prevailed in your life and that He has brought about deliverance or salvation either in times of turmoil, stress, distress, whatever. Think about how when He has delivered you in that, about how you felt toward Him, of the praise that you wanted to give to Him, of the glory that you wanted Him to receive from that. That's to be great, to be magnificent. In Isaiah, the 33rd chapter, to be glorious is to be powerful, to be excellent, to be mighty. In the 33rd chapter, again of Isaiah, starting at verse 20, Look upon Zion, the city of our solemnity. Thy eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation, a tabernacle that shall not be taken down. Not one of the stakes thereof shall ever be removed, neither shall any of the cords thereof be broken. But there the glorious Lord will be unto us a place of broad rivers and streams, wherein shall no galley with oars, neither shall gallant ship pass thereby. For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king. He will save us. Again, the glory of God, the excellency and mightiness that He has. To be glorious is to cause to make luminous, to shine. When you look at Psalms, the 76th chapter, verses 1 through 4. In Judah is God known. His name is great in Israel. In Salem also is His tabernacle, and His dwelling place is Zion. There broke He the arrows of the bow, the shield and the sword in the battle. Thou art more glorious and excellent than the mountains of prey. More glorious and excellent. This is what he saw firsthand, and this is what he attributed to God, that He was more glorious and excellent than anything that he had ever seen because of what God had done. To be glorious is to have splendor, honor, and majesty. When you look at Genesis, the 45th chapter, and verse 13. We have an example here of, in the human sense, that we can put over into the spiritual sense. Isaiah, the 45th chapter, and verse 13. After Joseph reveals himself, when you look at the character of Joseph, when he was elevated, that he was second to Pharaoh. Nobody else above him except Pharaoh. And that he had the whole Egyptian kingdom under his thumb, more or less, his rule. He had everything. And as his brothers are there, he says, You relay this back to my father. And he says, You shall tell my father of all my glory in Egypt. Of all that ye have seen, ye shall haste and bring down my father hither. And what Joseph was saying is, here's the report of my position in Egypt. You go tell my dad the position I have in Egypt, and you assure him that I'm going to be able to provide for you. And that was the assurance that they had. It wasn't just something that they couldn't or could. I mean, he said, You've seen my position. You go to report. And can you imagine the prompt and the splendor that Joseph had there in Egypt, considering the servants that was around him and how he would have been decked out and the palace that he was staying in and everything, and everybody at his beck and command, and all of that, and his brother seeing that, and he says, You go tell my dad
the glory that you've seen, and they would have been assured that he could provide whatever they wanted.
Yeah, but what I'm looking about what he had to go through all of that stuff before he got to that one point.
He had to go through trials and tribulations.
Here they would be.
But who delivered him?
The God. I believe God had him planned at the beginning to tie him out to see how much he could stand.
He did. And who got the glory for it?
God.
God got the glory. God delivered him for the glory.
The thing about it is, in Matthew 6:33, it says, if we seek God the first, he said, seek you first the kingdom of heaven, everything else will be added unto you. Now, he don't, that ain't a joke. That's the truth.
He'll supply our needs. He will.
He will.
So, to have the splendor and honor and majesty is the person to be able to be in that position to do what he says he can do, and the assurance that he is able to provide that, and God can do that.
Like in Romans 15:9, Paul talks about, and that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy, as it is written, for this cause I will confess to thee among the Gentiles, and sing until thy name.
The glory to be given to God,
right,
through his deliverance and his mercies. To be glorious is to have beauty which modifies the greatness. Think about that. Beauty modifies the greatness. To be renowned. To be renowned, to be known by all when you look at that. In Deuteronomy, the 26th chapter. Deuteronomy, the 26th chapter. And verse 19. And to make thee high above all nations, which he hath made, in praise and in name and in honor, that thou mayest be a holy people unto the Lord thy God, as he hath spoken. To have that beauty which modifies the greatness, when you look at all the other nations and what they thought about Israel, they did place them high in that. When you look at 1 Chronicles, the 29th chapter, 1 Chronicles 29th chapter, verses 11 through 13. Thine, O Lord, is the greatness and the power. This is David's prayer. And the glory and the victory and the majesty. He's got all these descriptive words here. For all that is in the heaven and in the earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom, O Lord. Thou art exalted as head above all. Both riches and honor come of you. Thou hast reigned over all, and thy hand is power and might. And thy hand it is to make great and to give strength unto all. Now therefore, our God, we thank thee and praise thy glorious name. The glory that is to be described unto God. The very nature of God demands that he be glorified by his creation. As a verb, to glorify means to honor, to be honored, to embellish, to beautify, based upon one's attributes or character. And we'll stop there, and we'll pick up there next Wednesday.